The boy still came every day. He dug and weeded and planted and mulched. I suppose he kept coming because of the money he was owed. But when the solicitor gave me some cash, to keep you going till your uncle gets back, and I paid the boy, he still kept coming. I watched him from the upstairs windows. More than once he looked up in my direction and I jumped out of view, but on one occasion he caught sight of me, and when he did, he waved. I did not wave back. Every morning he brought vegetables to the kitchen door, sometimes with a skinned rabbit or a plucked hen, and every afternoon he came to collect the peelings for the compost. He lingered in the doorway, and now that I had paid him, more often than not he had a cigarette between his lips. I had finished John's cigarettes, and it annoyed me that the boy could smoke and I couldn't. I never said a word about it, but one day, shoulder against the doorframe, he caught me eyeing the pack of cigarettes in his breast pocket. "Swap you one for a cup of tea," he said. He came into the kitchen. It was the first time he had actually come in since the day John died, and sat in John's chair, elbows on the table. I sat in the chair in the corner where the missus used to sit. We drank our tea in silence and exhaled cigarette smoke that rose upwards toward the dingy ceiling in lazy clouds and spirals. When we had taken our last drag and stubbed the cigarettes out on our saucers, he rose without a word, walked out of the kitchen and returned to his work. But the next day, when he knocked with the vegetables, he walked straight in, sat in John's chair, and tossed a cigarette across to me before I had even put the kettle on. We never spoke, but we had our habits. Emmeline, who never rose before lunchtime, sometimes spent the afternoons outdoors, looking on as the boy did his work. I scolded her about it. "You're the daughter of the house. He's a gardener, for God's sake, Emmeline." But it made no difference. She would smile her slow smile at anyone who caught her fancy. I watched them closely, mindful of what the missus had said about Isabel and the picnics. She was the kind of girl men can't look at without wanting to touch. But the boy showed no indication of wanting to touch Emmeline, though he spoke kindly to her and liked to make her laugh. I couldn't be easy in my mind about it, though. One morning we were smoking in the kitchen and I broke our usual silence. "Don't touch Emmeline," I told him. He looked surprised. "I haven't touched Emmeline." "Good. Well, don't." I thought that was that. We both took another drag on our cigarettes and I prepared to lapse back into silence, but after exhaling, he spoke again. "I don't want to touch Emmeline." I heard him. I heard what he said, that curious little intonation. I heard what he meant. I took a drag of my cigarette and didn't look at him. Slowly I exhaled. I didn't look at him. "She's kinder than you are," he said. My cigarette wasn't even half finished, but I stubbed it out. I strode to the kitchen door and flung it open. In the doorway he paused, level with me. I stood stiffly, staring straight ahead at the buttons on his shirt. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down as he swallowed. His voice was a murmur. "Be kind, Adeline." Stung to anger, I lifted my eyes up, meaning to fire daggers at him. But I was startled by the tenderness in his face. For a moment I was confused. He took advantage, raised his hand, was about to stroke my cheek, but I was quicker. I raised my fist, lashed his hand away. I didn't hurt him. I couldn't have hurt him. But he looked bewildered, disappointed. And then he was gone. The kitchen was very empty after that. The missus was gone. John was gone. Now even the boy was gone. "I'll help you," he had said. But it was impossible. How could a boy like him help me? How could anybody help me?